One, two.
This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week that was in all things cultural from your friends at National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulaby, reporter for the Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. You can get to Monkey See, find all the stories in their entirety, and subscribe to our podcast at our website, npr.org/Culturetopia. This week, we have reality TV with a twist, tales from the U.S.-Mexican border, and Bob Dylan in India, sort of.
And Bob Mondello in Japan, sort of. We'll take a look at a new film from Pixar that offers much food for thought and blogging.
But first, we're going to Broadway by way of the Library of Congress.
Yay! NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg did a report about a symposium that took place at the Library of Congress here in Washington, D.C. It featured some of the most unheralded figures from Broadway, orchestrators. Not composers, but the men who give composers' music instrumental voices, trumpets and fanfares, beds of lush strings under a memorable melody. You can hear Susan's complete story on our Culturetopia website, but we're offering an excerpt here.
A great singer makes the orchestrator's life easy, but get a bad singer, or non-singer, really, like a star of My Fair Lady.
Rex Harrison was a fine actor, but he had a lot of trouble singing.
Jeremy Lang's grandfather, Philip J. Lang, was the orchestrator behind this story.
My grandfather needed to do a lot of writing around his voice, as orchestrators so frequently do. He had to arrange it in the instrument such that Harrison could just speak in sort of melodic cadence, but he wouldn't actually hit any notes.
Women are irrational, that's all there is to that. Their heads are full of cotton, hay, and rags. They're nothing but exasperating, irritating, vacillating, calculating, agitating, maddening, and infuriating hags.
After the music rehearsal, Rex Harrison went over and embraced my grandfather and hugged him and said, "Thanks to you, I can sing."
With barely a note being sung. That's orchestration.
From the stages of Broadway to the small screen in Spanish, NPR contributor Nate DeMeo had this story about a reality TV series that is raising the profile of the reality genre among Spanish speakers.
When Lou Pizarro was a kid growing up in the Bronx, every Tuesday night was A-Team night.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit.
Young Lou loved the show, loved the car chases, loved the explosions. And when he got a little older, his love of A-Team style action led him to the Marine Corps, and later to a job repossessing cars.
That's where I got that idea from. I mean, I'm flipping cars. You watch the intro to the A-Team, they're flipping the Jeep. You know, I'm using helicopters, they're using helicopters. That's who I am.
For more than a decade, Pizarro was a successful repo man, parting people who were late on their bills with their stuff. It was dangerous, and it was fun. But he says as much as he enjoyed living like the characters on the A-Team, what he really wanted to do was make the A-Team, to make TV shows. He saw his chance a few years ago.
I got a call from Telemundo News Department. They asked me if I wanted to do the day in the life of a repossessor. And then when the news segment came out, everyone was saying, "Hey, you're the guy, the repo guy." And I'm like, whoa. So right after that is when I really, you know, put it to work.
He created a reality show called Operacion Repo. Each episode follows Pizarro and an A-Team-esque ragtag bunch of misfits, his fellow repossessors, including his sister and his 20-year-old daughter.
Hey! They're calling you a man!
The show's partly in Spanish, partly in English, and partly in bleeps. It airs on KWHY, one of the biggest Spanish-language stations in Los Angeles.
It was a totally out of the box.
Fatima Goncalves runs the station. She says she took a big chance by putting the show on her schedule.
Since we were born, we watch novelas.
Novelas, those soapiest of soap operas, dominate Spanish language television. She says no TV programmer wants to risk alienating audiences by introducing a new format. But she runs an independent station without much of a production budget.
We cannot compete with the big players of novela world. You need to come up, okay, what else I can do?
What she's done is get into business with Lou Pizarro. Repo's ratings were so good that Goncalves put it on twice a day, 5 days a week. Now Pizarro has two other shows on her station, one about a tattoo parlor and another about people who rush to crime scenes to sell video footage to news channels. He's also got a bounty hunter show on the national network Azteca America and a Repo movie on the way. And now, True TV, a reality network owned by the Turner Company, airs the English language Operation Repo.
Relax, you relax. Son of a f***. What's your problem, man? What is your problem, man? Relax.
It's a shame that they have to put people in the situation that they do.
Antonio Mejias Renta is the entertainment editor at the Spanish language daily, La Opinión. He's uncomfortable with a show that boils down to watching poor people get poorer. But he points out that the national networks cater to a broad international audience, with shows produced in Mexico and Colombia, and actors speaking perfect, accentless Spanish. At least Operacion Repo sounds like L.A.
In fact, they relish people who speak bilingually. They use a lot of slang, which is not something that you would find in network television, and I think that's part of the appeal.
Repo man Lou Pizarro says he's heard all the criticisms before, and he'll tell you there's a moral to the show. Don't buy what you can't afford.
The phrase, si no lo puedes pagar, no lo debes comprar. In English, it ain't no joke if you don't pay that note.
That's the show's tagline. It seems like it's plastered on just about every bus and bench in L.A., right below a picture of Lou Pizarro. He's probably the world's most famous repo guy. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
Luis Alberto Urrea has used the written word to examine the lives of Spanish-speaking immigrants along the U.S.-Mexican border, and he's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his efforts. His first novel is called Into the Beautiful North. It starts in a small Mexican village, and it works its way north, passing through Tijuana. Tell Me More guest host Jennifer Ludden asked Urrea about his experiences growing up in that border town and how they made their way into the novel.
It was really interesting to me because I, you know, born there and spent my first probably 4 or 5 years in Tijuana, and then we came to San Diego, and I didn't really comprehend a border. And in those days, the Tijuana border, you actually had to drive through the muddy riverbed and through this really bizarre, surreal slumland to get into Tijuana. But it didn't occur to me that they were different countries. It was just on one side of the river, Grandma lived, and on the other side of the river, we lived. And it wasn't until I moved away from the direct border region up into a white working class suburb that I started to understand that there was this divide and that the people to the north of it didn't have a very high opinion of Tijuana. I thought Tijuana was pretty cool, you know, until I found out it wasn't. Everybody told me it wasn't. I thought, well, that's interesting.
In the middle of the book, there's this really wrenching scene that takes place in Tijuana, and I just want to read a bit of it and ask you about this. Some characters have just been deported from the U.S. back into Mexico.
Yeah.
And you write, Tijuana's street toughs with nothing better to do entertained themselves by jeering at deportees as they came back to Mexico, tired and dirty and downtrodden. Old hands among the returnees knew the border game and faded away and vanished among the tough guys and headed back to the fences. But the fresh meat, the crying ones, the hunched and scuttling, guilty-looking ones, they were the source of sport and derision. Did you really see a scene like that?
Oh, yeah. One of the points I try to make in the book is for most of the population of Tijuana, they have nothing to do with this thing and they have their own lives. But there's a certain substratum of society that often preys on these folks, and the people coming back, they can tell a lot of the kind of low level criminals or tough guys in the street or, you know, cholos with nothing better to do, or sometimes just low-level coyotes who want to get a quick buck and try to hustle those folks. They kind of shadow those people. If you know where to look, you can see all the stuff that's in the book, yeah.
You know, you just don't hear stories like that very often. You don't see them reported in the news as much as you'd think you might. And it's so amazing to me that an author, that the way we hear these stories is by someone writing a fictional novel about the place where he grew up.
And from the border between Mexico and the U.S., we'll go to the border between China and India. It's the site of a most unlikely celebration, an annual marking of the birthday of Bob Dylan, who turned 68 last week. NPR's Philip Reeves told a great story about a diehard Dylan fan named Lou Majow, who for 37 years has kept Dylan's 1960s ethos alive.
The celebration begins. His gray hair now flying loose, Majow prances around the stage in his micro shorts.
Feel the writings of Bob Dylan. That will definitely open the doors of your soul. I am sure. Because I am sure because I know it. I know because I am sure because it happened to me.
The crowd listens calmly. Majow mixes Dylan with some of his own numbers. He's master of ceremonies, ushering in other musicians. No one seems to find him odd.
Everybody knows about him. Everybody knows him. That is there. And he's one of the pioneers. There's no doubting those kind of things.
Keith Wolang played in Majau's band for years.
People just treat him the way he is, and that's about it. They just leave it at that, you know?
Because if you were to go to many towns in India and wear a pair of micro shorts, earrings, beads, and have long hair in a pigtail, you'd be in trouble.
For sure, for sure. But this place is definitely different from the rest of India, as you probably see. So I think, people have accepted him a long time ago, and they look at him and they enjoy seeing this colorful person on the road, I think. So I think it's all good.
As darkness sets in, the sound of Bob Dylan wafts across the hills of northeast India. There's just one more question for Lou Majau.
Geez, the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. Okay, what about this?
Do you think Bob Dylan knows that you do this every year for him?
I don't think so, yeah. I don't think so, yeah. Maybe he knows. I doubt, yeah.
Would you like him to come here one year?
It'd be fantastic, yeah. I mean, like, I guess when that happens, then the people of Shillong say, ah, yeah, Dylan, we love you.
Philip Reeves, NPR News.
And you can hear Philip's entire story by going to our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
Onwards to Japan. That's the country that produced last year's Best Foreign Language Oscar. The Departed just opened here in the United States, and NPR's Bob Mondello reviewed it.
When a Tokyo orchestra goes bankrupt, its cellist, a young sad sack named Daigo, finds himself unable to support a big city lifestyle. So he and his wife move back to his rural hometown, and he starts a job search. There's no orchestra to work for, but an ad offering a career working with departures sounds promising. The travel industry intrigues him. So he arranges an interview and is hired almost before he sits down, at a high salary, too. There is, however, a catch. The word departures in the ad was a misprint. The job involves working with the departed, the dearly departed, preparing bodies for cremation. Daigo is about to leave when the boss offers him his first day's salary and suggests he try the job and see. And soon the musician, who's played winningly by Masahiro Motoki, starts to get in touch with his inner undertaker. The stylized ceremonies, all performed with grieving relatives in attendance, turn out to require nearly as much delicacy as playing a cello did. Daigo discovers the rituals have a real beauty to them, also a habit of not going quite as planned, which can lead to unexpected comedy. What the film doesn't say, but what Japanese audiences would know, is that Daigo's initial reluctance isn't just about what he sees as the job's ick factor. Dealing with dead bodies and dead animals was regarded as unclean in Japan for centuries, and that prejudice dies hard. Those who prepare bodies are still widely discriminated against, and that discrimination can extend to families, so that if, say, your great-grandfather worked in a slaughterhouse, you may have trouble landing a job. So when the film empathizes with Daigo as his wife reacts with revulsion or his neighbors shun him, it's engaging in social criticism, which may be why director Yojiro Takita built so much humor into the story, even though slapstick seems at odds with the material, and why he made the visuals so seductive. The strategy definitely worked for Japanese audiences, who forked over more than $60 million at the box office, and while this lovely, sentimental film is hardly likely to have success on that scale in the U.S., it will absolutely delight the art house crowd. Multiplexes will be crowded with noisy summer films, after all, from which Departures will represent a sophisticated and elegant departure. I'm Bob Mondello.
You know, Linda, it's really hard to put together a really sound, rich radio piece without hearing people talking, and especially in English. Here, we didn't hear anybody speaking from The Departed, and yet at the same time, you could get this really vivid picture of what the movie looked like when Bob described it.
Another movie that has some very vivid imagery in it is the new Pixar film, which is called Up, and it's about what would happen if you tied 22,622 helium balloons to your house. It features a grumpy old man named Carl, a persistent 8-year-old wilderness scout named Russell, and some very adult ideas. NPR's Melissa Block asked UP's screenwriter and director Pete Docter about how he and co-writer Bob Peterson saw the symbolism of all those balloons.
Yeah, there was something about, I guess, balloons somehow seem to be like a metaphor somehow for life, that there is something very temporal about them. You only have them for a short amount of time. They either you accidentally let go and they float away, or they shrivel and they're gone. And there was something about that that seemed to relate to relationships in life that Bob and I started playing with. And we came up with this little relationship between this old man and this wilderness explorer who has every single badge that he needs except his assisting the elderly badge. And that's why he's been pestering Carl.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
I could help you cross your yard.
No.
I could help you cross your porch.
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
How important is it to you to balance, you know, the obvious fun and excitement and pure joy of movies like this and the sort of the darker and deeper underlying themes that are all over this movie? I mean, there's an absentee father and there's the loss of a lifelong love. How do you make those two things mesh, and how important is it that there are both of those things in this movie?
Well, looking back on the films that I grew up on that I loved as a kid and still love today, they all seem to have those elements, you know, that there is, say, for example, Dumbo. There is a lot of fun. There's pink elephants on parade and all the fun with flying with the storks. And yet you also have these very tender, sad scenes that as a parent now you look and you go, oh, my gosh, they can't even see each other. They can only hold trunks through the cage, you know. The baby mind sequence is just so touching. And to me, that's what makes those movies stick with you. You know, they're a lot of fun, a lot of action and adventure. But unless you have that emotional kind of touchstone and foundation, it doesn't really stay with you as you leave the theater. And that's what we were trying for in this film.
Linda, this movie actually moved you to write a letter to the people at Pixar, which you posted on your blog, Monkey See, this week. What did you say?
My letter was called, Dear Pixar, from all the girls with Band-Aids on their knees. Dear Pixar, this is not an angry letter. It is especially not an angry letter about Up, which I adored. I could have sat in the theater and watched it 2 more times in a row. I cried, but I also laughed so hard in places that it wore me out. So I'm not complaining. I'm asking. I'm asking because I think so highly of you. Please make a movie about a girl who is not a princess. Of the 10 movies you've released so far, 10 of them have central characters who are boys or men, or who are anthropomorphized animals or robots or bugs, who are voiced by and imagined as boys or men. These movies feature women and girls to varying degrees, The Incredibles in particular, but the story is never a girl and the things that happen to her, the way it's a boy and the things that happen to him. I want so much for girls to have a movie like Up that is about someone they can dress up as for Halloween, as Anika Noni Rose said about starring as the voice in The Frog Princess. Not a girl who's a side dish, but a girl who's the big draw. And I'd really, really like it not to be a princess. My understanding is that after the summer blockbusters of 2010 and 2011, Toy Story 3 and Newt, you're planning The Bear and the Bow, a Christmastime fairy tale rather than a summer adventure, and your first one about a girl. Way to go. But why, oh why, does it have to be about a princess? Again. At 2 Pixar, I have nothing against princesses. I have nothing against movies with princesses. But don't the Disney princesses pretty much have us covered? If we had to wait for your 13th movie for you to make one with a girl at the center, couldn't you have chosen something, for her to be that could compete with plucky robots and adventurous space toys? Or more to the point, why couldn't your first female central character be as specifically drawn as the women and girls and girl robots and so forth you're already writing as secondary characters? Ratatouille has a chef. Wall-E has Eve. The Incredibles has superheroes. There's nothing wrong with the movies you're making. I'm sure your princess movie will be my favorite one ever. I'm just saying, keep them in mind, those girls in Band-Aids, because they want to see themselves on screen doing death-defying stunts, too. You're making some of my favorite movies in the whole world right now. Please, please make one about a girl who isn't a princess.
Amen, sister.
So we had a very good conversation among the blog commenters, where they recommended various movies that have girl heroines. They recommended books that they like. It turned into a really terrific discussion. And we have links to all the stories we heard today. And you can also subscribe to our podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
And don't forget to check in with Linda and her commentators on NPR's arts and culture blog, Monkey See. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. I'm Netta Ulibi.
And I'm Linda Holmes.